Welcome to Scary Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Swager and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing and subscribe to our podcast. Leave us an awesome five-star review and follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter.
We're here to talk more about cybersecurity. Each episode will focus on a specific topic of interest to the community, and today we are talking about hiring.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers.
Wonder how much it would cost to hire Dave Chappelle to write good jokes for us, you know, since he's been canceled.
Well, maybe he's cheaper now than he was.
I still can't afford him even if he was cheaper. All right. To start off this, just give kind of some context around why we're discussing hiring. The other week, I saw an article from Daniel Meisler, you know, one of my typical go-to places. He was reposting a piece by Brian Goldberg that's no longer available online. The title of this article is Losers Exist, Don't Hire Them. And I think that Daniel Meisler is a pretty smart guy. He usually writes stuff that I really agree with. But in this case, I was not a big fan of what I saw. And I know that he didn't write it. He was just, you know, espousing it. My problem is not necessarily the premise that's do not hire losers. I think that some of the example questions he had in there were just not phenomenal examples of how to find losers. And, you know, like most writers, he couches this advice within the context of a story. He tells a story about how his sales operations team needed to hire somebody and they interviewed people and he got through the technical interview. And then this guy, the author, hired him and he grilled him on his hobbies and his college and then was like, this guy's a loser. We don't want him.
It's very Steve Jobs-esque.
Yeah, I could see that. So I wanted to kind of pull out some of the questions that he asked and talk about those. And then we'll dive into kind of a broader discussion of hiring. So the first question he mentioned was, he asked this guy, tell me about what you studied in college, because he said he had an English degree and he was expecting him to be able to say something interesting about English. And his expectation is that, you know, somebody can talk reasonably eloquently or at least passionately for a few minutes on your 4 to 6 to 7 year college experience, regardless of what they did. So for example, I was a geology major and a computer science minor, which is the second part's related to security, but the geology part is not really related to security. So I was a little annoyed by this. College for me was 17 years ago. I don't remember much about it, at least not that's relevant to work. And, you know, not necessarily that I'm going to talk about like, oh man, we used to throw these crazy parties and I had the crush on this girl.
Yeah. I actually think there's a better question to be asked here. And this is what I typically ask folks who are interviewing for security positions who have a college degree in something that's other than IT or security. And I ask them to try to relate how that field that they study relates to security or what they can bring from that field into security that's going to help make an organization more secure or help you do your job better.
Yeah, I think that a question like that or even a question like this is fair if somebody's like 5 years out of college. But I think asking like a senior level engineer, a principal level engineer, a, you know, director about their college experience is probably you're not going to get the result.
Yeah, it's time sensitive, you might say.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. And that does make sense that when you're talking to somebody that's fresh out of college and doesn't have the work experience to refer to, like, yeah, this might be a interesting kind of, you know, tell me about something you're passionate about, because you can't tell me about your last job because you haven't had one in the industry yet.
Right. Or, you know, how you flip burgers at McDonald's is really not helpful.
I learned that I hate that and I never want to do it again.
which is usually what you hear from people who have worked at fast food. I know My brother worked at a Hardee's and he's like, I will never, ever eat Hardee's ever, ever again.
I lasted 2 weeks at a fast food job. I lasted a bit longer in retail. Retail was not as tough as fast food.
Yeah. Thankfully, I never have.
Yeah. Second question. Tell me about your hobbies. His point here is that a person who has no hobbies and can't even exaggerate one almost certainly lacks ambition. So there's an interesting point here where, at least for me in my 20s, at least in my like kind of late 20s, when I was trying to get into InfoSec, it was my hobby. Like I was working full time and then I was doing InfoSec, you know, taking classes, going to conferences, studying up, doing, you know, various CTFs online and stuff like that because I was trying to break into it. So I didn't really have any hobbies at that point in time. Although I'm certain the hiring manager, at least at the time, they certainly accepted InfoSec as a hobby.
Well, I mean, it's still something that you do after work, which is wasn't your what your actual job was. So I think that's perfectly acceptable to say that, well, that's a hobby. Yeah. Now, my problem with this question is the lack of ambition. Like, I'm not sure that really is relatable to, you know, whether you have a hobby or not, it's directly relatable to their ambition on the work or on the job.
I went back and just looked at the article. He did say ambition, but I don't think ambition is the right word. Passion. So, I mean, right now my hobbies are completely unrelated to work because when I get done with work, well, except for this podcast, most of my hobbies are completely unrelated to work because when I get done with work, I don't want to do it anymore. I want to do something else. That being said, I have heard other people ask this to, you know, get a sense for who the person is. So I don't necessarily have any issues with it as a question. I just don't know that it tells you quite as much as he thinks it wants to tell you. Although, you know, if a person does say they have no hobbies, like if you're like, what are your hobbies? And they say, oh, I like to go home and watch TV. I don't know that I would hire them. I don't know that I would necessarily call them a loser. I don't necessarily know that they would be a bad employee, but they certainly sound like they'd be a boring employee. Maybe that's what you want.
Well, I think rather than whether they're boring or not, I think what is at the heart of this, that maybe he just didn't know how to word it correctly or whatever. Maybe he didn't really think this through, but it's whether that person has additional experiences, you know, life experiences or whatever outside of the office that is going to teach them something that they can use that knowledge to still apply it at the office. You know, if someone's a history or maybe an economics has a hobby in history or economics, you know, maybe they will learn something in those fields about some event or, you know, something in that's relatable, you know, time preference or whatever, that they can then say, oh, well, this is kind of like economics in this way. And this is how, if you look at it in this perspective, it makes more sense for us to approach a problem this way or something like that.
Yeah. I don't know. I definitely was thinking also during my 30s, I didn't really have hobbies. I mean, I guess you could say I had hobbies. I certainly owned hobby equipment, but I didn't have time for it because my kids were growing up and I was mostly focused on being a parent. I was mostly focused on growing my career and I didn't really, you know, take the time to do much other stuff.
Yeah, I would imagine that's true of a lot of parents that, you know, outside of work, their kids are their hobby or they take the majority of their free time up.
Yeah, especially with those crazy parents that, you know, oh, my kid is doing basketball tonight and tomorrow is piano and the day after that is violin or,
overscheduled. Yeah, that's just one kid. You add a second or a third one in there and forget about it.
Yeah. All right, next question. So what do you think of our website? And this is to scout for basic due diligence in preparation for the interview. And saying if they did not do their due diligence to prepare for the interview, then they have no common sense and they're a loser.
Or if they're afraid to answer, they're weak and have no opinion.
Yeah. I have never done this. I have never, like, I know that it's something you're supposed to do. Whenever I've never gone to like a company's website and look at what they do, because maybe this is specific to information security, but I guess it'd be different for sales. Like if you're doing sales, you probably care a lot about what you're selling. But for information security, like we do it no matter what you're selling. Now it may affect how we do it, but it has never been, my research is always like going to Glassdoor reviews and seeing like, what's the work culture like? What are the salaries like? As long as the company is reasonably moral, I don't care what they sell. When I say reasonably moral, I would never work for Wells Fargo.
Well, Wells Fargo just got caught. That's awesome.
Again.
Or as usual at this point, really. Guess,
yeah, really. Yep.
But I think it's a good idea to check their website though. At least go in and read their mission statement to see how they view themselves. You know, what's important.
It's gonna be lies about how wonderful they are and how they're doing this for the planet.
Yeah. I mean, Google did say don't do evil. So
yeah. I mean, I guess it's a little not sarcastic, but a little when I think of that word. I used it just the other day talking about cyberpunk. Cynical. It's a little cynical, but you know, companies are in the business of making money for the most part, and usually they don't really give a shit about the people in their way. But
well, one of the things that I always do though is look at the LinkedIn profile of the hiring manager if I know who that is, to get an idea about what their background is, what they're like, you know, what their experience is, and maybe if possible, find something that's relatable in my background to their background for a common point of interest. And I actually had a mutual friend of ours before he interviewed for a job one time, ran an SSL Labs scan against their website and then printed out the report and brought it to the interview and showed him a report and said, which was not good, handed it to him. He said, yeah, I think I can help you out with this.
I mean, depending on what the job is, it certainly, and he was coming in for a manager job, right? Or an architect job?
Director
job. Yeah, that makes sense. Like if you're coming in as a pen tester or something, obviously you don't want to actually pen test, but you know, running some quick scans and being like, it looks like this is a problem. You know, we could investigate it, you know, showing that, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because really what he was saying with that was, you know, I understand you have some challenges and I know how I can help you with those challenges. True. So I think it was a fairly good approach, at least in that situation. I know I made a mistake in an interview. This CISO had, he was the original security engineer for this company.
Uh-oh.
And he built their security stack on all open source stuff. And I made the mistake of kind of questioning that as whether that was a good idea or not. And he did not take it too well. I mean, he didn't get irate or anything, but the expression on his face was obviously, you know, I was like, man, maybe I should not have said something about that. Needless to say, I did not get that job.
So next question was, which of your previous jobs did you enjoy the most? And I actually do kind of like this one. I think this one's pretty good because I think that a lot of people struggle with exactly what they want from a job. And this lets you know if the culture that they want is similar to what you have on offer. This may be one where, for example, they're like, oh, you know, I really love that my previous job gave me all this flexibility so that I could take long 3-day weekends. And maybe you're a company that does your IT changes on the weekend and you need the people, your security people to be on the line for some reason. And that would be an obvious mismatch.
Right. Or I spent most of my time dealing with auditors and it was awesome.
As the security engineer manager or the architect. Yeah.
No, I'm just saying, maybe that is someone's ideal job.
Gotcha.
Snatch that guy up right away and, you know, sit him in the room with the auditors.
he's the sacrificial guy.
Sacrificial guy on the post.
Yep, exactly. We'll talk more about culture in a bit, but lesser managers will frequently try to stump candidates with horrible brain teasers. This actually goes two ways. What's described here is when you get into a bad situation, that's not a brain teaser though. I thought this was.
Well, Brian couched it as, you know, that's a brain teaser, which, I thought that was a little bit odd as well.
Yeah, because I thought when I saw.
A crap question.
I agree. That's the, what do they call that? Like the behavioral questions or something. There's a specific name for that technique in interviewing. And yeah, I think it's a crap technique, at least for technical roles.
When some of the reason people ask these questions is ludicrous as well. I worked with one guy that every interview would always ask, the last question would be, if you were a drink, what drink would you be? And he did it just to mess with people to see what they would answer. And I was like, that is completely pointless. You're wasting everybody's time with that question and you're not furthering the interview process.
But it's hilarious. You know, actually, I could, oh my God, now I want to put together a list of like nonsense questions like that for when I know, you know, when you get like 15 minutes in the interview and you're like, all right, this is not what we want, but you're afraid to cancel the interview right then, which I've done before. That was very awkward. And I was like, I think there is a mismatch on expectations here. I don't think you're really who we're looking for. And we shut that interview down fast.
Yeah. I've done that too. Yeah. I feel bad for the guy.
Yeah, I did too. But it would be hilarious to start asking nonsense questions. Like, how many ants do you think will fit in a mason jar? If you were an imaginary animal, what animal would you be?
The flying spaghetti monster obviously would be the right answer to that one.
Yeah. As for the brain teaser questions, I know that like Google and some other tech companies got really famous for doing like how many ping pong balls will fit in an airplane. Pretty much everybody's decided those don't actually work. Those don't show anything as to success in jobs.
Yeah, I think what they're trying to do is like you have some kind of lateral thinking or something like that.
Maybe if the job required it, but most jobs don't. Most jobs require you to learn a specific skill set and implement that skill set.
Yeah, because I can't remember where I heard this story from, but they had asked a candidate, you know, how many different ways can you turn off this light? Or you can get this light bulb not producing light anymore. And he's like, you know, smash it, turn off the switch, pull the breaker. And, you know, you just went farther and farther away from the problem to say, you know, this is how you turn off their light. And I'd be like, And they were like, oh, well, this guy's awesome. We're going to hire him right away. He's like, maybe. I don't know. But I think a better type of question like this is what I've asked before of candidates to try to see if they have a security mindset is, you know, for what you know about our organization, how would you steal from, and, you know, not exactly asking, you know, technical questions or whatever like that, but, you know, in general, how would you go about that? Because I think it's, you know, having that security mindset or the hacker mindset, and then how you want to couch it, I think is important for security to, for people to look at problems from that perspective, from the attacker's perspectives.
Yeah.
But one thing Matt and I talked about the offline that, you know, we're both not terribly good at is that in interviews, a two-way street.
Oh man, we're experts at this. We're so good at this. Don't listen to them.
Yeah. That's why we're both, you know, so high up in our organization.
It's a choice.
But the interview is a two-way street, right? So, you know, they're interviewing you to find out what you can bring to the company, but the interviewee or the candidate should also be trying to find out, you know, what that company is going to do for the candidate. Well, not do for the candidate. Maybe that's a bad way to put it, but, you know, why should the candidate or why should the employee work for that company? What's so great about that company? You know, are you going to be able to solve challenging problems? Are they just going to pay you a boatload of money or, you know, why should you work for that company?
You know, and that's actually, especially now with security people in such high demand, I have never had so many recruiters reach out to me. This is a big, big part now because now you have a choice. Sometimes you don't have a choice. Sometimes you just got to take who's paying the bills. But right now, if you're in security and you're looking for a new job, you got a choice.
Yeah, especially if you, you know, depending on your years of experience.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, 1 year of experience. Maybe you don't have much of a choice. So I know one of the big things that's always on my mind when I'm looking at a company is what's their culture? Are they high pressure but crazy partiers? I used to work for a consulting company and they would throw all kinds of company paid for happy hours and stuff like that, but they expected all of the hours out of you. I mean, what's that thing that you typically hear? We work hard and we play hard. I usually mean 60 to 80 hours a week, which, you know, if you're in your 20s and you're trying to make your name and you're trying to get out there, that may be fine. But if you're a parent, you've got stuff to do. Maybe that's not what you wanted. Maybe that's not where you want to be.
Yeah, I worked for one company that had a break room with a wine fridge in it.
I know. I've been to the office down in Florida, and they've got a keg in there that they break out on Fridays. I have no idea what their work culture is, though. Next, what's the hours expectation? And obviously, typically in almost all jobs in security, it's a salary job. You are there for the work, especially if you're doing security analysis, like your hours, or if you're doing incident response, your hours might be wacky. But you still want to find out, generally speaking, is it a Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 job? Is it a, you know, 6 days a week, 7 days a week? Ask about, you know, what happens with after hour emails? Like, when do I answer those? Maybe the expectation is that, you know, the boss wants an answer back in an hour. Other bosses are like, don't touch that until Monday morning.
Right. Basically, is there an on-call part of the job?
Yeah. Yeah. And just, you know, how much work are you expected to get done? We talked about this a little bit before the podcast started, but especially when you're on salary, you're supposed to be working until the job gets done. And while the managers may not give you specific hours, they certainly can give you more work. And then, you know, at the end of the year, ding you and be like, well, you didn't meet my expectations because you didn't do all the work, even if that work would have taken 60 to 80 hours a week to do.
Right. Basically make sure both sides understand the expectations.
Yep. Because that would, again, If you want that high pressure environment and you don't have hobbies and you're trying to, you know, make your way and get a name for yourself, maybe you want a high pressure environment that's going to push you and you're going to learn and you're going to grow, and that's fine with you. But you don't want that if you're expecting to, you know, take off early every Friday to, you know, go out with your daughter's travel soccer team or whatever. Finally, you may want to ask what the performance management process looks like. I've worked for multiple companies. They've all been slightly different. Well, at least one company I worked for, everybody got the same 5% raise every year, which is funny. At the time, I was like, 5%. And in retrospect, I'm like, I'll take 5, please. Can I have 5? One thing that's
I was going to say, that's not even meeting that.
Yeah. I'm actually super curious what's going to happen this year. If they're going to adjust raises based on inflation, or they're still going to be like, you lost money this year. Congratulations. We'll see. One thing that occurred to me, actually, if you're a manager, is whether or not you would control budget. Different companies treat this in different ways. I know when I was running the SOC, I had no control over the budget. The budget was all controlled at the CISO level, which was extremely frustrating because anytime I wanted to do literally anything, I had to go beg the CISO for money.
Does that include labor?
Well, I was more thinking in terms of like, you know, when I was running the SOC, like, oh, you know, let's do a team building event, or let's all do a happy hour or something like that.
I mean, every place that I've actually worked at so far in a leadership role or a management role, labor budget was not part of my team's budget.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. No, I was more talking about other stuff like new tools, like having, and I know, again, a lot of places, the budget process is in, but like at where we worked together, where I was a SOC manager, like I didn't have any budget. And CISO never consulted me and asked me if I wanted budget or what I would do with budget. So, and maybe if I'd been a little bit older, a little more experienced, I might've gone to him and been like, hey, but for example, there's like a training budget, then, you know, every manager can approve training. He doesn't have to go to the CISO. There's a travel budget for each group. There are tool budgets that are planned out. And, you know, if something comes up that we're like, oh, we really need this, like the manager has the ability, depending on the price limit, of course, like he's not running out and being like, I'm gonna spend $2 million, but if it's, you know, fairly inexpensive, he has the ability on his own cognizance to be like, all right, we're going to do this. So if you're applying for manager positions, like that may be something that you care about.
And if they expect you to control budget, they may even ask you budgeting questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I had actually recently taken a course from ISC Squared called Creating a High Performing Cybersecurity Team.
Did it work? Have you created high performing security?
Well, this is really all around the hiring process. Mm. Very little deals with post-hiring other than like team events or whatever that try to keep morale up. But it's $200 for non-IC Squared members. If you're a member, it's free. But one of the things that, you know, that they were, I don't want to say harped on, but one thing that they focused on in the course was that the candidate is the most important person in the entire process. So, you know, as a hiring manager, you should be completely focused on ensuring that candidate is pleased with the process and understands exactly where everything is at in the process and how the steps are going and everything like that, which is probably a pretty good perspective, but I'd never heard it put quite that way. But in that course, they talked about how, some of the things that I got out of the course was that, you know, The building the job description is actually a real critical part of the whole process, which makes complete sense because you really need to make that job description fit what you're really looking for in there. And it can be hard to do that when HR or there are other dictates from the company about how those job descriptions are supposed to go. Because if you have, you know, different functions within the team, although all the folks on the team have the same title, it can be difficult to get exactly what you want in a job description. If HR says, well, this is the job description for that role or that title, and this is what we're posting. And one of the other interesting things that was in that course was that they said on the phone screen, you should not ask any technical question. The expectation is that the phone screen is more for like a cultural fit conversation. And then if they pass that, the decision to bring them in for an in-person interview should be completely dependent on what it says in the resume. And that's never the way that I've ever done it. I've mostly done phone screens to have them, you know, relate what's in their resume to see if their resume is accurate or not.
Yeah, because you can write anything on a resume. You can write anything on a resume.
Yeah. I mean, too often, you know, the resume is, so to say, embellished.
Do you remember that analyst we hired into the SOC that had the absolutely phenomenal resume and just in person was just super mediocre? Like couldn't remember, couldn't apply things. Like he had all kinds of tests and all kinds of certifications, but couldn't apply any of them.
No, I don't remember that one, but that's
It was the one where we knew his wife.
Oh yeah. I don't remember what his resume looked like, but his wife was like a bulldog in him. You know, we were expecting the spouse to, you know, we really hired that guy based on his spouse more than him, you know, which was a mistake
because we expected his interview was
similar
super
personalities.
Yeah. Yeah. His resume was pretty good. Like he had checked off a lot of boxes and we had the opposite. There was that guy that was a vet tech and his resume was crap because he was a vet tech. And when we talked to him, he'd been doing like some hobby stuff on the side and he had a pretty good handle on like technology. And then the CISO was like, no, we need more FBI agents. And he wanted, or it's not what he wanted specifically, but he wanted to hire analysts from the government.
Yeah, I didn't care for his perspective on who was really good at security or not.
Yep. And again, but that actually goes back kind of to what I was talking about with the budget too. Not only the budget, but as a hiring, like if you're applying for a place as a manager, like who's responsible for the ultimate hiring? If you're the manager or if you're a manager who's doing the hiring, like do you have final say on the candidates or do you have to get approval from someone else? Because that's interesting.
Well, even if you do, you know, are they going to defer to you or not? Are they going to defer to the manager or not?
Yeah.
Because ultimately, whoever's responsible for the budget for that organization is the one who's going to say, you know, you can hire this person or not. But if they defer to the hiring manager who says, yeah, I want to hire this person, then that's fine.
Yeah.
But the previous CISO at that organization did similar shenanigans to other people who wanted to hire as well. Quite annoying. I actually asked a friend of mine to interview, and the interview went great. The other engineers said, yeah, I mean, obviously I wasn't involved in the interview. The engineers were like, yeah, he's good. We should hire. And the VP was like, yeah, I think we can get someone less expensive. And we couldn't find anybody for 2 months. And then the VP came back to me and said, hey, is your friend still interested? I was like, oh, man. Needless to say, the answer was no.
Yeah, can't imagine why. All right. I also wrote down some notes from a book I read. Back when I was a manager, I read the book Work Rules, Insights from Inside Google That Will Transform How You Live and Lead by Laszlo Bock. He was a Google HR VP. And I had a couple notes on here that I found really interesting because at this point in time, I was looking at hiring. And one thing that they said is that hiring is the most important thing that a manager can do. Because if you hire good people to start with, your job is infinitely easier and your team is going to be so much more successful. Whereas if you do bad hires, you're going to spend all of your time trying to make that bad hire into a good hire or doing crowd control of all the issues from that hire. So they're very much, which actually kind of matches up with what you're talking about from that course you took, where they were really focused on the hiring process rather than the management process. So Google found that the wisdom of the crowds was better than any single person for determining successful hires, except they called out they had one engineer that was better than the group, but they never found a way to replicate that one engineer because they kept track of how successful each hire was. And then the, you know, yays and nays of all the people that interviewed them, because of course, Google keeps track of everything. They found that group panels led to 86% good hires, which is pretty good. That's 6 out of 7 good hires. That's real good. And the optimal number of people in a panel was 4. Too many more, and they started stepping on each other. You know, you get 8 or 9 people on a panel, they each only get one question.
Right. And plus, it's intimidating for the candidate, really.
It's like they're sitting in front of a judge and a jury.
Yeah, they've been brought into the star chamber.
Yeah. Google thinks that there should be standard questions for every single interview, and they should be the same questions asked of every candidate for that role, so that they can be directly compared and that you know kind of ahead of time what a good answer is for that. So you've got answers you're looking for.
Yeah. And I've tried to implement this most places that I work, and, you know, considering you're trying to do this for the panel, you need to try to get the buy-in from the other panelists that you're planning to have on there. And I've gotten a huge amount of pushback from folks not wanting to do standard questions.
Which I think I think partially makes sense and partially doesn't. For example, so when I was hiring for security analyst positions, I did have a list of standard questions, which include technical questions. But on the other hand, having a list of standard questions means people can't dive into the resume.
Well, you always leave, if you leave time at the end, you know, or time at the beginning for that, I think that's fine. But, and you could use that. It's kind of like having that information as a modifier to the answers to the standard questions. To indicate whether, you know, this person is better than that person. But what I don't understand is why people don't like this concept, because the standard questions can be developed as a team, you know, versus one person developing the questions and having it all out there. So there's people who sit on the panel and are going to do ask the questions, could already have those questions ahead of time, which, you know, they had decided they were going to do, would just have that as part of the process.
Yeah, that does feel like you're almost using people as sock puppets. Like, here's the questions I want you to ask. I mean, yeah. Although you're still getting kind of their insights as to whether or not they like the person or not.
Right. And that's really where you're going to get it from. I mean, the one challenge of having the panel interview and having, I guess maybe the panel interview is fine, but still the hiring manager has to be the decision maker and not just go with what the panelists decide, because you can end up with the groupthink, or, you know, end up with, if everybody thinks the same, then they're all going to agree on the same type of person to adopt. And sometimes I think it's important for the hiring manager to be able to say, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I disagree, you know, because I have actually made the mistake of not exercising that type of veto on a hire, which I came to truly regret later.
Hmm. Yep. They also recommend you include a cross-functional interview as a check, which is interesting and makes sense. I think the cross-functional interview would ideally be somebody that interacts with the person. You know, if it's a vulnerability management person, bring in somebody from IT, like a systems administrator, and get a feel for how they are going to work with them.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
And they said subordinate should interview future managers and buy in, which I don't know that I've ever been anywhere that's done that.
I have.
How was it?
It was okay. I mean, ultimately, virtually all of them said, don't hire this guy.
And they hired him anyways?
Well, they hired me anyway.
Oh, I hired you and they hired you.
Yeah.
That's funny. You're like, I'm going to be a real hard ass. Like, no. So,
I was the least bad choice is really what I came to find out.
Wow. All right. That's fair. I don't know. I don't know how I feel about that. I don't know that you should necessarily let subordinates be kind of the deciding maker, but it certainly makes subordinates feel like they're included. I know it definitely feels like when I get a new manager and I've never even met them before their starting day, I'm usually like, well, I mean, it's mostly worked out, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that person is, you know, whoever that manager is that's being hired is ultimately going to have to convince those employees to do their job. So if based on the interview, the employee's like, this guy's a jerk and I don't want to work for him.
I mean, that just gives you enough notification. You can start looking for your new job.
Quite possibly. Yeah.
And anecdotally, I've been seeing a lot of pushback on Reddit on this long hiring process. Because Google talks about, like, the Google interview is, you know, you do your phone screen, you do a technical interview, then they bring you in for panel interviews. And the panel interviews, like, it's not just one panel interview, it's multiple panel interviews. Their hiring process takes weeks. And there's a lot of other tech companies that do similar things, you know, 4+ interviews over weeks or months as they try and schedule it, because they're really desperate to avoid that bad hire, because a bad hire can take, you know, months to years to get rid of and undo the damage. Mm-hmm. So, for example, for the last job I had, the last one that I'm willing to disclose about my interview process, there was a phone screen. Then there were 3 interviews with single people. Then there was a final day of interviews on site where they flew me out. And I talked to some pretty high ranking people and then had a final kind of interview with HR on the process. And that did take weeks and it took money. Like, they flew me out to interview on site. It was pretty extensive. Yeah. Some of the other interviews that I've had in the last couple of years, I had a phone screen, then I had an in-person panel with a hiring manager and a vice president. That one was interesting because that one was for a manager position, and I definitely, none of my supposed subordinates were going to be there. Actually, no, I think there might have been one there. There may have been one analyst there that kind of sat quietly through the whole thing. Then another one I had, there was a phone screen, then there was a technical panel with people that would have been my peers. And then finally, there was a final interview with the hiring manager, which I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on these? Do you have any examples of interview processes you've been through or interview processes you liked?
Interview processes that I liked. I mean, the typical that I've experienced has been, you know, phone screen and then, you know, one or two panel interviews. I did have one where I ended up doing 3 panel interviews and then a final interview with the VP of the architecture team. And all of them went great up until that very last one. That killed the whole thing. But that took several weeks to get done because with the panel interview, you have to ensure you have everybody on the schedule that has the time to do it and all that. So, but I think how extensive the interview process is really mostly reflects on the expected value that the company is anticipating this person is either this position is worth or they expect to get out of that individual. Because you certainly aren't going to do, you know, like a four multi-panel interview for, you know, a very, very junior, you know, analyst. But if you're hiring a director or a manager or a senior manager, you know, you certainly want to spend more time getting that right, because the expectation it would be that that person is going to be some kind of force multiplier to make the team that's under that individual do better or do well. So it's important to get those right.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think my ideal kind of balance for most analyst and engineer positions is the three interview, phone screen, technical panel, and then a final interview with whoever's got the hiring authority.
Yeah, I'd say in general, that's most of the standard practice you're going to see. Usually, you know, the second two are in person. Although sometimes, I guess, with this whole you know, remote work thing and COVID and all that, a lot of, you know, the second and third ones are probably being done virtually.
I've decided at this point that I'm never going back to the office again. The most that I'm willing to drive is like 20 minutes, which is a very small circle of places that I can work in person.
Well, when you're a rock star like yourself, you can have all those kinds of options.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of us are less fortunate.
Yeah. All right.
Oh, right. So going back to the job description for a second, building that job description, which is really the way which is critical to the whole process, you have to know what your expectations are for what this individual is going to do and build the job description around those facets. You know, what do they need to know? What experience do they need to have? And try to avoid generic job descriptions if you can. As I mentioned before, though, HR is going to try to force that on you to say that, oh, well, this is an engineer position, so this is the job description for that engineer. But if you're bringing in an engineer to specifically do, you know, proxy stuff, maybe the stuff that you have in your generic job description about, well, had, you know, antivirus experience or whatever, it's not going to, does not factor into really whether it's not going to get you the right candidate pool that you want. And I would also say, don't, and this is what I would say for any position at all, do not force a degree requirement. I mean, you know, much happened in associates, bachelor's, master's, whatever. I would not put that on in as a requirement. You can have it as a nice to have, but certainly do not require, you know, a junior level analyst to have a bachelor's degree. You're going to miss out on a lot of good candidates by forcing something like that.
Yeah, I've got two stories about this, actually. My first job, my first IT job, our boss required us to have degrees, which was utterly ridiculous. I could have done that job in high school. And there probably were middle schoolers that were able to do that job, but he would only interview people with degrees.
Yeah, I worked at one company where HR said we had to have it on there, and we tried to hire somebody without it, and they made us turn them away.
Ridiculous. Yeah, there was another one where they would hire somebody without a degree, but they wouldn't promote them. There was a certain level. They couldn't be a senior level without a degree. Like, they had some sort of internal requirement that anybody over a certain job grade had to have a degree.
Yeah, that does not make any sense to me at all. I think we talked about this before, you know, that my understanding of college degrees in the modern times is it's just a signal that you're willing to suffer for 4 years to pay for it. It doesn't really tell anyone outside of, other than that, about, you know, your ability to do the job that you're being hired for.
Yeah. And that's a big thing for certifications too. Certain certifications like Security Plus and CISPE, I feel like, are just mostly HR checks at this point. What's the other one? Certified Ethical Hacker for the government. There's certain ones the government requires, certain ones that people put on job descriptions, and then know which certifications are actually value add, like some of the SANS one. I know there's one that I talked about, eLearn Security, the junior penetration tester, was only like $400, and it had like a full week, like it was like a 40-hour class, and I learned quite a bit. And that's a cert that no HR person's ever going to hear of. Like, they're going to look at that and be like, I've never heard of this. What is this?
Right. Yeah. It doesn't sound impressive.
Nope. I mean, it's a script kiddie cert. It's like, here's how to be a script kiddie. But it was super useful. What was most useful about it wasn't the classes, it was the labs. It was the fact that they provided like 32 hours of labs. Like, that was the useful part. So once you have your job description, what are you going to do with it? Well, you're going to post it on your website and then everybody's going to come, right?
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah. You definitely do not want to just put it on your website. That's an automatic fail. You'll want to look at putting it out on all those job boards, you know, Monster and all that stuff. Although that's still not great. There was a position I posted a senior analyst position when I was a manager. And over a year, we had two barely qualified candidates, of which we ended up hiring neither because neither of them were really qualified. Although part of the question there is that was not a large company. That was not like a large name brand company. So it may be that if you're a bigger company, you have lots and lots of applicants, which is why you need to do other things like recruiters. Recruiters are generally pretty good.
And they're going to cost.
Well, yeah. What do they normally charge? Like a month of salary?
I think it's more of a percentage. Oh. I've seen, you know, 15 or 10 to 20% of the base salary.
Gotcha. But which also
recruiters, they can be really good at getting you good candidates. And usually that's maybe can be individual recruiters, but it can be certain recruiting companies are just generally better at doing this than others.
Yeah. I've worked with Ninja Jobs in the past. They're pretty good. I was pretty happy with them. But the best way to do it is to go out to where the security people are and hunt them down. They're getting a lot of attention from recruiters. Like I said, something about this last 2 years is just, I've gotten more recruiter attention than ever before. Until I put in that I would only move jobs for a 4-day work week. And then it's so weird. All the recruiters stopped. But anyways, if you really want to go, go figure out where they are in your area, especially if you're not doing remote work. If you're doing local work, you know, go out to the local B-sides. Figure out where your local, you know, hardware hacky or hacking group comes together. Maybe figure out where the maker space is and maybe sponsor stuff in your area. If you have budget, go to meet and greets, find them. Because if they know you and they think you're a cool manager, they're going to be way more likely to come work for you as opposed to the recruiter, which is the recruiter is going to promise them whatever. All right. Job titles. You want to talk job titles and progression?
Sure. I mean, job titles. It's really hard to speak to job titles because virtually every place I've ever been, the job titles don't necessarily carry across, you know.
Yeah. That was my point. My point is it can be hard to parse based on the job description, exactly what your level in progression is.
Right. And because I worked one place where, you know, an analyst too was actually an engineer. The job title did not really accurately reflect exactly what was expected for that role.
I've seen the opposite. I've seen where people are listed as engineers because that's the only way that HR will approve a higher salary. Because if you go look at salaries, analysts only make so much. If you want to make more than that, you got to be an engineer.
Yeah, that's true. Because I have been places where the natural, you know, it's talking about career progressions. The progression from analyst is engineer, where they expect you to move from doing analytical work where you're looking for, you know, looking for the bad guys to deploying and managing software, which don't necessarily translate. And in some analysts, you know, that's not what they want to do, but they would like to get a higher salary.
Yeah. There's a website called levels.fyi that directly compares Google, Microsoft, you know, all the FAANG companies, et cetera, because these are so confusing. So for example, I will admit up until about 2 years ago, I thought senior was where your progression mostly ended. You got your senior and then you either moved off to be a manager, you moved off to be an architect. But I discovered today that Microsoft has 8 levels of software engineer above senior.
Where they just, are they the Newspeak dictionary? Were they just double plus senior good? Or
hold on, I didn't actually, Microsoft. So you start off as a software development engineer. Then there's another level. Then software development engineer 2. Then another level. Then senior. Then another level. Then principal. Then 2 more levels of principal. So there's, I guess, 3 pay bands within principal. And then partner. Then another pay band where I guess you're still a partner, then distinguished engineer, and then technical fellow. So senior, and then this is something that we'll talk about a little bit when we talk about salaries, senior analysts on average only have 2 to 4 years experience. So senior, depending on where you are, may mean a lot more than at other places.
Or, you know, senior, based on what you just said, you know, senior isn't, the expectations for a senior are not what you would think.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking again at levels.fyi and assuming this is accurate, a senior software development engineer at Amazon may be the equivalent of a principal software design engineer at Microsoft.
Right.
Yeah, they're close, but they're not exactly. So it's definitely just, and then the point here is not to, you know, exhaustively go over, but you know, you may want to ask them, you may want to say, what's the progression look like? If I want to continue doing this role Am I able to be promoted in place? Are there levels for me to be promoted to? Or do I have to wait for somebody else to, you know, up and leave or a new role to be created before I can move into it?
Right. And that's something I'm not typically very good at asking either.
I am not either. That's fair. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, because that was one of the things that I wondered too, because I'm like, I've only been doing security for 10 years and I've been a senior engineer now for like four. Like, so I was only had 6 years of experience before I was a senior engineer. Like, what do you do now? Do you just be a senior engineer forever for the next 20 or 30 years? So I'm glad that a lot of companies have places to go. I just have to figure out how to get there.
Yeah, well, maybe it's like, you know, going from high school to college, they just roll back to freshman, you know, you're senior and then you're a freshman. And you just go back up to the
college. You know. Maybe.
Or maybe they just tech on citizen to be.
You know what? Hold on. One of the levels was like a weird, there we go. Google. You go from being a senior software engineer to being a staff software engineer and then a senior staff software engineer. Interesting. Anyways, weird levels. That's one thing you may want to consider when you're applying or when you're hiring people is about remote work. You've got some pluses and some minuses. A plus is a better list of talent since you can hire from anywhere. But of course, the negative is it's harder to integrate people into the team. And the same goes if you're hiring for those remote hires. You're probably going to be expected to work a little bit harder at integrating into the team. And you will probably have to do more to try and prove that you're actually doing work, which is bullshit because lots of people are very good at not doing work in the office. But for some reason, managers seem to think that, you know, if the person's right there, they're going to work harder.
Or they're doing work while they're there at all.
Yeah, because nobody surfs the internet while they're in the office, right? Nobody brings in Legos and plays with Legos on their desk.
Or reads the newspaper.
Never seen it. Yep. And well, finally, let's talk a little bit about salaries before closing this out. And the only reason that I'm even bringing this up is like yesterday on Reddit, I saw somebody claiming that security people in San Francisco could make $400,000 plus as a security analyst. And I don't know that I believe that. I believe that for a software engineer that's writing tools, but I don't believe that for a security analyst. So I went up and I looked up some numbers on Glassdoor, and I just found it was really interesting. Like being a security analyst, widely varied. It ranged from 49,000 to 140,000, averaging 80,000 across the year. There was a standout there, Leidos. Apparently somebody reported a 227,000 salary as a security analyst from Leidos. Wow. I don't know if they met like a financial security analyst.
Oh, you mean securities analyst?
Maybe. I don't know. That seems so widely out of whack with the rest. Becoming a senior security analyst boosts the salary to 88K to 158K with an average of 118, which is pretty good. Like that's a good middle class lifestyle. And the average years of experience for a senior security analyst was 2 to 4, which makes sense to me. We've talked before about how analysts should be moved up and out of a SOC 1 position pretty quickly if they're good, because you don't want them to grind away. I don't know exactly how SOC 1 and 2 mapped security analyst and senior security analyst, but 2 years seems about right for some, or less if they're good.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, security engineers make 75K to 154K, about the same as a senior security analyst. Average years of experience is 4. They did break out. So Glassdoor is this kind of neat area where they break out the regular versus senior versus principal versus lead. And so the regular engineer was averaging in DC, 120,000. Moving to senior got you an extra 6,000. Moving to lead got you an extra 31,000. And moving to principal got you an extra 10,000. It was kind of interesting. The difference between senior and lead was pretty big.
Well, it's probably because the expectation of some kind of management or leadership role in that title.
Yeah, like a team.
They're
going to
be doing more than just engineering.
Security manager. I was kind of surprised about this. I expected this to be at least commensurate with security engineer, but it was actually a lot lower. It was 41K to 136K with an average of 74K. Quite a bit lower than a security engineer, quite a bit lower than a principal security analyst as well. I don't know if they're with the salaries like that, there's the lowest salary there is even lower than a security analyst. It makes me wonder if they're incorporating physical security as well.
Oh yeah, that could be, because those titles aren't exactly specifically spelled out.
Yeah, that's difficult to split out. So. And then the big surprise for me was security architect, averaged 86K to 274K, twice as much as everybody else, basically, except for the except for the, you know, principal engineer. The average years of experience was only 5 to 7. So apparently I'm slacking. I made senior engineer at 6 years experience. Apparently I'm a little slow.
No, that's obvious. So anybody who's listened to us.
That's fair. And the final one I looked up was vice president security, because I kind of wanted to see what the CISOs and that level is making. The minimum is $144,000, which I was kind of surprised about, but I could see maybe a small company up to about $350,000 with an average of $225,000. Now, I will point out that all these numbers are salaries. They don't include cash or stock bonuses, because some of those were pretty widely variable depending on where you are. But that's just something to think about if you're, you know, thinking of, you're looking to get into security and you're listening to us. It's a pretty lucrative right now. It's not quite as lucrative as software engineering, but it's more lucrative than most of the other things you could be doing in an office.
Yep, sir. And of course, in the age of COVID, don't forget to ask about their vaccine policy. But obviously, you know, if they don't have a mandate, you may want to get some kind of assurances that they're not going to implement one after you've gotten there, or what's going to happen afterwards if you don't accept the vaccine into your life. Well, what the consequences of that are going to be. And with that, I think we'll wrap up. So that's all that we have on this topic. Please listen and follow us on Twitter at SarahGettySec, and download and listen from your favorite podcast app.
Or just tune into the waves inside your head. Are now being distributed via ESP.